Yeah, so thanks everyone for sticking around to the last talk of the workshop. I feel like the last three conferences I've been to, I've been scheduled the morning after the conference dinner, and this kind of feels like the same thing, despite being a very long conference.
Very high quality crowd.
Yes, it's true. Yeah, that's true. Everyone actually came. Usually that doesn't happen. Yeah. So usually, or at least recently, I'm more of a supernova or transient person, but today we talked about a lot of supernova and light curves last week or 2 weeks ago, so I thought I'd talk a little bit more about something I've been thinking about, yellow supergiants. And it's something that I've been thinking about for maybe 5 or 6 years, and also they're a type of star that's gotten a little more attention in the last 5 or so years due to the fact that now sometimes they do explode as supernova, which I'll touch on a little bit later, but they're very interesting for other reasons in terms of stellar evolution. So this is not going to be a talk in which I present tons of awesome data. I will do that, but then tell you exactly what it all means. That's not going to be this talk. It's more going to be trying to motivate you what yellow supergiants are, why they're interesting, why they're hard, and then try to convince you that we are now starting to take data that will hopefully help us unravel some of the questions about them. And I'm hoping it's interactive, so please interrupt and give comments. There are people in this room who are more of an expert on certain aspects of this than I am even, so especially the theoretical interpretation of some of these stars. So any questions right off the bat? Okay, awesome. So what are yellow supergiants? They are stars that are intermediate in temperature. So I would usually, the definition's a little rough, but picture in your mind supergiants which are in temperature somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 degrees Kelvin. So I've just marked it here. Depending which paper you read, they're going to designate exactly what they mean separately. But the bottom line is they are stars that are transitioning in the HR diagram. So the traditional picture of what these stars are in the most simplistic single star evolution case is that you have stars in the main sequence that then transition across the HR diagram before going up the red supergiant branch over here. And generally, this is thought that it should occur. This is a very rapid transition, generally on about the thermal time scale of your envelope. And so it can happen on the order of something like 10,000 years. So very short in time in terms of the overall evolution of the star. So perhaps in that sense, you think it's not actually that important for the evolution of massive stars. But it turns out there's a lot of very interesting things that you can do in here. So there's already several interesting features you can notice on this, my drawing of an HR diagram. First off, so at some of the lower masses, you get these blue loops, which sort of pass into this regime. And exactly where those occur is somewhat is uncertain. And at a certain point, you have stars which just pass through this part of the diagram and then go up the red supergiant branch. But at a certain point, I could have drawn one that sort of, I guess, imagine this looping in there. At a certain point, these stars will actually start to evolve back towards the blue. And it's very interesting to know where that happens if you're interested in things like what the final state of massive stars are, what types of stars will explode as different types of supernova, various things like that. But it also turns out that it's really hard. The devil is always in the details. So exactly where these sorts of loops and these sorts of turnoffs happen depend on everything in your stellar evolution code. In particular, how you treat your mixing, how you treat your convection, what type of mass loss you use at every evolutionary state. Because one of the main things that dictates whether star will go blue again is the core to envelope ratio. And all of those things affect that. Not only that, in the yellow supergiant regime in particular, your stars are going to be very sensitive. The lifetime it takes to get across there is going to be very sensitive to all of those things. So we've been doing a little bit of digging over the past week or so in exactly what is predicted from a wide range of stellar evolutionary models as a function of luminosity and other parameters, what the lifetime to get across is. And sometimes it's as short as 10,000 years, but if you tweak your model parameters a little bit, it can jump up to as much as in some models it takes 1 million years to get across. Because in that case, you actually start your core helium burning when you're over in the blue and slowly work your way over as opposed to zooming across and then doing core helium burning over here. So you can get wildly different lifetimes and therefore predicted populations of yellow supergiants depending what the exact details of your models are doing.
So when you said you tweak all these different parameters, what are you finding your most, like, are you finding that you're most sensitive to convection? Are you most sensitive to the mass loss? Like, what is the thing that is...
You're most sensitive to whatever is going to change this core to envelope ratio.
That's the key parameter, then, the core to envelope mass ratio.
Yes, yeah. And also, though, it starts to get into certain things, like some things that can allow you to sort of stick around in this region more. There are details like if you form an intermediate convection zone or if you don't, which again are subtly related to all of these different things. But if you do manage to form it, you can really sit around this region more as opposed to just zooming across the HR diagram.
And this is all single star, so are you going to get to the binary?
Yeah, just warming up for why it's even hard to single star first. So in addition to that, and still just within the single stars, it turns out that these stars in themselves are incredibly difficult to model. There are several aspects of them that, you know, are just complicated physically when you get there. For instance, good friend, the Eddington luminosity. So there's this kappa here. So often when we talk about stars that are reaching or exceeding their Eddington luminosity, we're talking about hot stars where you get iron effects in your opacities. But once you get to cool enough temperatures where hydrogen can also significantly contribute, you also get stars that are actually at or potentially exceeding their Eddington luminosity, but over at cool temperatures as well. And that's very relevant for the red supergiants, but also some regions of the luminous and yellow ones. This starts, it's sort of in this region, in the middle of the zone, where that starts to be important. Same with, you can get turbulent, turbulent pressure in the atmosphere. So again, as you're going across, at a certain point in this zone, your envelope goes convective, and you can actually get large-scale macro turbulence and turbulent pressure that's present in the atmosphere of these. And you can see that sometimes in the spectra you see from them, as well as just some of the variability is probably due to that sort of thing. And again, that's starting to happen as you move across the HR diagram, and it's hard to know exactly how to incorporate it into models. Similarly, there's just instabilities. Again, up here, your envelope is very, very loosely bound, and so there's a lot of instabilities that can happen. You also, down here, I'm going to get the temperature range exactly wrong, but your Cepheid strip goes like this. And so usually when I talk about yellow supergiants in my head, because I do supernova, I think of anything that is of a mass that would eventually explode. And the top end of the Cepheid strip does overlap with the bottom edge of that. At a certain point, you stop seeing Cepheids, but that region does overlap. So you do get Cepheid-like pulsations in some stars that are in this region as well.
How many bona fide yellow supergiants do we know about total?
At this point,
yeah.
As of like 4 years ago, like 600.
Okay, total.
Yeah, and that's between some in the galaxy and then M31, M33, the Magellanic Clouds. That sort of magnitude, though.
Yeah.
So a few hundred in each of those.
We lost one in 2011.
Yes. And then, yes, if you go extra galactic every once in a while, yes, you lose a couple as they explode, which I will also get to. Yeah. Yeah, so there you get instabilities in that region. And then, of course, the mass loss itself, it's uncertain. We don't really understand red supergiant mass loss. And then right in this region, again, you're transitioning from the state where you're too cool to have really strong line-driven winds, probably, but maybe not quite cool enough to have dust-driven winds. But not a lot is actually has been empirically known about what the mass loss in that regime is. And if you really are just zooming across in 10,000 years, it probably doesn't matter that much. But if that's not true, then understanding the physical conditions, and especially that transition, and whether there's a region where you're trying to launch a wind, but it's starting to fail because you're not quite enough yet, and how that impacts the evolution of these stars, that is all happening in this region. And so it's inherently a dynamical process in this region in general, because things are happening so quickly, and then especially at the upper luminosity end. And so every code has to make decisions about how it's going to handle that. And pretty much all of them, actually, to get things to evolve across the Hertzsprung gap, have to make some sort of fudge in how they actually do it. Some codes are more honest about what they're doing than others. And so sometimes it's hard to tell what exactly is going on. Mace is very honest.
That is. Bill's not here.
Yeah.
They really only have to fudge at the very above 20.
Yes, yeah, that's where sort of the mixing link theory that you use breaks down when you're above.
So when you said you were comparing different codes to get across, which codes were you? You were talking about the diversity of the duration.
Of the durations. Yeah. So at this point, we've looked at the various versions of the Geneva models, the STARRS models, and then some of the MESA models. In particular, the ones that are published online on the MIST website. We haven't run our own at this point yet. So, Yeah, and it can vary dramatically, and also varies dramatically with things like metallicity and how the lifetimes go. So yeah, it matters a lot, and it matters a lot in terms of what populations you're predicting, which has influences on your understanding of all these other stages. So it's sort of a region that even just in single star evolution, you can imagine a situation where if you actually understood what stars actually existed in this region, they could form a careful probe or test of some of these aspects of the physics that are so uncertain. But to do that, you need to both identify them and understand what they actually are. And that gets into what Juna mentioned. Everything I've talked about so far has just been single star evolution. But clearly, this region is also very important for binaries. For the first case, as you're going across the Hadron diagram, your radius is expanding dramatically. So you, any of these binaries that were wide enough that you didn't interact on the main sequence, a ton of them are going to interact in this region. So I've seen estimates that for O and B type stars with initial periods, assuming some mass ratio between about 10 days and 100 days, will definitely interact as they are going across the Hertzsprung gap. And then there will be other ones out to about 1,000 days that maybe won't interact in the yellow region, but will start to interact over in the red supergiant phase. And then that's essentially a mass loss. And then it can sort of trigger blue loops for binaries that are up to about 1,000 days. And so all of that is happening in that region as well. And so you can have things, sometimes it's stable, Roche-Lode overflow. You can also have a lot of common envelope evolution that happens in that region. These are rare to detect, but there are a few observed examples. So Jose Prieto in 2007 published a paper on it's a yellow supergiant plus a yellow supergiant. It's an overcontact binary. It's actually two yellow supergiants together in an overcontact binary. There's another example in our galaxy, which was...
Was Prieto in Magellan Clouds, or was it?
It was in, Homburg 9. Yeah, Homburg 9.
I'm just curious about metallicity.
Yeah, so it was a dwarf galaxy, so that was a low metallicity for this one in particular. I think Nathan was on this paper as well. This was I didn't write the phone number for it, but this was a yellow hypergiant. I said I'd get the word hypergiant. So that's a word that is sometimes referred to when people talk about the most luminous examples in this temperature regime. You get a few stars, which I'll talk about, up near luminosities of about 6, and sometimes people refer to those as yellow hypergiants because they're particularly variable and unstable. But this was one in the galaxy that they observed with VLTI. So in a Fraunhofer, and actually we were able to resolve it and found that it was actually probably overcontact or even a binary that was undergoing common envelope evolution right now. So one component was a yellow hypergiant and then a lower mass companion. So they said the mass ratio was about probably something like 10 in this case. So it was a lower mass companion in this case. So it was actively undergoing common envelope evolution right now.
And are they monitored so that they're periods or not?
So that one, after going back to like a 60-year light curve, they were able to recover a period. With these in particular, it's hard because there is this intrinsic variability probably related to this turbulent pressure and other things that are going on. There's some sort of intrinsic variability that we don't actually understand well yet on top of that. So it's hard to pull out, but you do in some cases see periods that can be pulled out.
So how will we know the mass ratio?
Nathan?
This one turned out to be an encrossing binary, but it was only recognized after this image with the VLT, and they're like, oh, we should look at the historical record. Regular, very shallow eclipses embedded upon this ridiculous variability in the star. Spectra, and you can measure radio losses.
So the mass ratio is known by the factor like, of 10% or the factor of 2?
Yeah, so I'm not sure.
No, I mean, because, I mean, we know that for yellow hypergiants, they kind of really stable up to the mass ratio of 8. So, I mean, when you say 10, and so, I mean, if it's a factor...
Definitely a twiddle 10, I think.
Because, I mean, if it's 5, then it's stable mass transfer. If it's 10, it will be covenant below. So, I mean, let's say...
I would say that the ratio of 10 or 1 is a factor of 2. It could be anywhere from 0.05 to 0.2.
It's probably not an equal mass system like the other one.
Uranium is a
faint hot star.
Yeah.
But this has presumably been followed up like crazy now.
No.
Really?
People don't study stars.
the first author died. People are still following him.
You work on stars, you work on it at your own risk.
I mean, the young chick trying to die too.
Okay. And the third one I wanted to mention related to that. And
sorry, where is that? Is that
it's in the galaxy.
The number two.
Yeah, in the galaxy.
Yeah, in the galaxy. And the third thing I wanted to mention, an observed example related to the binaries interacting on this phase, was published by Nadia, who's a postdoc at Caltech right now. This was actually a transient source, so it was a luminous red nova in M101, I believe. And they studied it, and they put forth in their paper that they posited it was the ejection of a common envelope. Envelope was what caused this transient that peaked at like minus 12 or minus 13. And there was actually a progenitor pre-detection of this, and it was a yellow supergiant, was what this system looked like. It was just shy of 5, so like around here on this diagram was where the pre-explosion detection of this faint transient that's been interpreted as a common envelope ejection was found. So there are examples also from extragalactic transients that are pointing towards these sources being important.
Find it again afterwards. Is it something?
I mean, they're definitely continuing to monitor this one and make sure that it's really gone. Yeah, so this is a recent result, so they're continuing to follow it now. Yeah, absolutely. That then also ties in, as we're getting into extragalactic detections of yellow supergiants, the fact that longer than that, but definitely it's gained more popularity in the last 5 years that there are supernova progenitors that are yellow supergiants. So there are about half a dozen of these now. And they're all associated, so they all sort of fall again in the similar range, but sort of they spread in temperature. So some of them are a little shy of what I would call yellow supergiants, but like this, and then one of them's a little bluer. There have now been about 5 yellowish supergiant supernova progenitors in pre-explosion HST imaging, and they are all type 2b supernovae. So those are supernovae that have a little bit of hydrogen left over when they explode. And these are great, and it's sort of, we can actually start to piece together a nice picture for these now, especially with the half a dozen or so well-studied objects. You can get things that, for instance, from these pre-explosion imaging, you get some constraint. Now, usually you just have one or two bands of observations. That's how supernova discoveries, pre-discoveries go. But you get some estimate of the luminosity and the effective temperature of the progenitor before it exploded. This type of supernova as well, from studying the supernova, we have constraints in the fact that there's a little bit of hydrogen left, but it's in an inflated envelope. So it's a low mass but inflated stellar envelope. And you get this from actually the supernova light curves. So they're ones that show this character. So this is just time of the light curve. This is some sort of luminosity, but some of them show this very prominent double peaked light curve where the time scale for this is a few days up to a week. This is the normal nickel peak for the supernova. But when you model this sort of light curve peak in terms of you interpret it as the cooling of the envelope that's been shock heated by the shock going out, you get constraints on both the, so from the light curves, you get constraints or estimates of the radius of the star and the mass that's in the envelope, depending on your study. And there are now enough of these that we start to see a variety of behavior. So this is one example. Some of them have longer ones. Some of them have shorter ones.
Can you give us a sense of the order of magnitude of the delta?
Yeah, so
So
for these early peaks, so I mean this is like maybe 18 days to peak of the nickel, but for now these early peaks, we have ones ranging from events like 93J and 13DF. This first peak lasts about a week that it is very prominent. There are some now that we've gotten data early enough that we do see a bright peak in fall, but it lasts an order of 2 days. And then there are some that, to the best of our constraints, have not shown something like that. But if it were something that lasted a day, maybe our data isn't good enough. But everything from about a day up to a week.
And from the first minimum to the peak is, what's your factor of luminosity change? Is that factor 10, factor 2?
No, it can be up to a factor of 10 in the for the ones like this. For the ones here, it's not very much at all, because they really just start to blend together where the early peak is overlapping with the NICA one. So the longer the time scale, the less difference you see. But it can be a factor of 10 in luminosity for the fast ones. And when you do that, you get radii which are very consistent with actually what you see for imaging, where you have radii that range from maybe 50 solar radii up to about 600. And it correlates well with which ones were where they were placed on the HR diagram and what you expect. So the ones that have redder generators over here, they have inferred radii of several hundred, which all sorts of makes sense. And the ones that are over here, they have inferred radii of more like, like 50. And it also correlates with what mass you infer for the envelope, where these have maybe a hundredth of a solar mass hydrant left over, these closer to a tenth or a few tenths of a solar mass.
Does it make sense if it's actually this, post-common envelope kind of deal? Is it still
I'll mention a paper in a second that pieced it together, along with one other piece of information that we have for these supernova progenitors now, is that we can use radio or X-ray emission to actually probe the pre-explosion mass loss of the progenitor system. So your shock is interacting with the medium. You can get details on the density of the material around it. And you actually find things that, span an order of magnitude. So they vary, at least in their densities. If you estimate, if you were to assume a velocity or the wind of like 100 kilometers a second, you infer a few times 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year as the sort of pre-explosion mass loss from the system. But in particular, there is also now an observed correlation between the density of the immediate CSM around these and these other parameters, where you have the ones that are bluer and have smaller radii and smaller amounts of hydrogen left over have lower CSM densities around them than the ones over here. It's higher CSM densities. So some of this could be accounted for by the fact that your velocity is actually, wind velocity should be different depending on what the star is. So your escape speed is different. But there's some arguments that still you might actually have a difference in the mass loss rates. There was a paper actually that there have been two this year, one by Yoon and one by a student of Kenichi Maeda's that just came out this week that attempt to say that if you do take this picture of interacting binaries, and they don't actually consider the common envelope ejection, they're considering ones where you have stable but non-conservative mass transfer, that you can actually get a picture that sort of makes sense with all of this.
Stable makes more sense if you have an extended envelope.
Yeah. So you should still have common envelope things happening in here, but in terms of the 2B progenitors.
I guess I'm just wondering if, something has to break, right? Because you can't, if you're getting your radii and your envelope masses and your M dots all right from a single star perspective, then either that has to be wrong, right?
Well, what are we getting from the single star?
If they still have hydrogen in the envelopes, so that was non-conservative masses. And this is what we find for yellow supergiants during this period. They will have very high rate mass transfer. Which is, it's stable by new regimes. In the past, they just like when you go to this rate, your people just say, okay, now it's unstable.
Yeah.
But it is stable. Mm-hmm. You just can calculate it. The system goes very nicely through it. Mm-hmm. If it will be common envelope, then how you can keep some point of hydrogen?
It's hard to know how you can keep.
To me.
But it's not necessarily a problem. Like the ones that are the bluer progenitors, they don't have as high mass loss rates inferred from the CSM. They lost their hydrogen envelope, but they might have done it a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So they may have, the other ones might actually be in an active mass transfer phase, so they have a disk around them. So
yeah, and there's some arguments that the mass loss rates or densities you get from the supernova observations of these are higher than you infer in with the sort of normal mass loss prescriptions for what a star there would be. And that's one of the arguments for why maybe it is that they're actively undergoing non-conservative mass transfer. Now, I don't know how well the mass loss rates are actually measured here. Like, those are not, especially in the yellow regime and even slightly red regime, that there's not really very good empirical constraints on what the mass acceleration of those stars is actually doing.
But definitely, your point that people taking a star and saying, we're fitting a single star, extrinsic parameters to it, that, well, this is what it was before it exploded,
right.
And that's the most simplistic. So that Lagerhild Nova thing, if I'm thinking of the right transient, if that's a mass transfer becoming unstable, you might say that's after delay dynamic instability with your friend Rob, right? I mean, so that mass transfer phase could have been on for a long time and then become unstable. And if so, it would be about the right place, this yellow supergiant. That doesn't mean it was a single star that was a yellow supergiant and then it suddenly became unstable.
Yes.
But if you read the papers, you think, oh, it was here, therefore it was this star, and it suddenly became unstable, therefore we draw these conclusions.
Yeah.
Which is exactly the thing you want to
know. Yeah, no, I mean, if you're right, if you're inferring these parameters in a purely single star regime, then it seems like if you treated everything as binaries or everything as single stars, you have to get different answers for those.
Yeah, and I mean things though, like you're getting this from modeling the early light curve,
right.
And so you come up. I mean, and so people like create these. Well, you have to get to the stellar structure they assume somehow, but then they just blow it up and infer what the radius would be. So yeah, as long as you can self-consistently get to some structure, which will be different for binary versus single star, but I don't think that these necessarily assume.
But the fact that you find trends, okay, there's six, but the fact that you find trends in the HR diagram means that when there's many more, this should actually be very discriminating, I think.
Absolutely.
Because we can't land on the same part.
Yes, 2011 DH is one of these.
And I recall that it was one of the rare examples where the polarization went down over time.
Yes, there was something.
There was something non-spherical happening.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And there were high absorption
in the polarization. Oh, in the spectrum. Yeah.
Well, actually, coincidentally, the two Bs are overrepresented in spectral polarimetry, and so almost
all of the sort of standard
extensive ones. Studies.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Why is that?
It's happened. They have a double peak, and so you get warned, and then later you
come back. It's like, oh, this one's cool. Yeah, absolutely. Excellent. So.
And just to, before you move on,
yes.
The mass loss from this M dot,
yes.
Since we're talking about a handful of supernovae here, if I recall correctly from radio and X-ray studies of 93J, which is sort of the reddest one of these five objects, it's inconsistent with being steady M dot, right?
Yes.
Lots of evidence for.
Yeah, so most of them, if you follow the radio and X-ray, mostly radio is easier to follow the longer times, you start to see. So radio light curves that sort of go up and down, but then they show these modulations, which you can fit the one rise and fall with just a synchrotron self-absorption spectrum. But as soon as you start to get other times going up, it's best explained by density modulation. So you're sort of running into other shells or material. And definitely the ones that are redder show this a lot more. The data is sparser for some of the other ones, but there's at least one of these that it seems much smoother for one of the sort of bluer ones, whereas you have these sort of modulations that you see in the redder ones other later times.
And in 93J, there's a resolved radio shell, the LBI, Robert Martel and collaborators.
Mm-hmm.
And it's patchy, but it's not, definitely not. And it's
more spherical smite expected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so so there have been papers now and explaining this sort of trend as these binaries undergoing mass transfer. The one thing I wanted to mention, because several of us were at this conference a few weeks ago on CAS-A, so CAS-A was also a 2B and fits in the general picture of a lot of these. Clearly, we don't know if it was a yellow supergiant or not, but there are actually very deep limits on any leftover companion afterwards that rules out most of these scenarios that I was just telling you about, the nice pretty picture for what 2Bs are. And it actually seems like it's to the point where it's disconcerting. And I didn't realize how disconcerting it was until going to this conference, that there really is not a leftover companion, or if it is, it's very, very low mass. Even Selma was disconcerted by this, so you know that's a problem. Yeah, and so, I mean, people at the meeting a few weeks ago were starting to talk about mergers as a possible how CAFE happened, but then the question is, how does that actually fit in with all of these other 2Bs? Because we had light echoes for CAFE, and it was a very normal 93J-like type 2B. We know that. And so if that was a merger, does that mean some of these are, whereas we have sort of a nice picture via a different type of binary mechanism that explains the extragalactic one. So I think there's still some, I don't know if you'd call it tension, but it's, yeah.
It's weird because 93J has a blue, it's not just supergiant, but a blue luminous blue star at the same position after the supergiant phase.
Yeah.
If that were to cascade, it would
be. It would be so, yeah.
So to go back to that, so you could eject, Chris and I talked about this a few weeks ago, you could eject the original hydrogen envelope with the common envelope to make you happy, mm-hmm. right? And then merge the low mass hydrogen rich star onto the exposed helium star to put some hydrogen back again to make you a 2B.
Yeah.
Okay, that's getting crazy for the closest, wellest observed supernova we have, right?
Yeah, well, EB7A is weird too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. But that's a way to do it.
Why isn't that crazy?
I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's an intricate way to get what you see. I like that. Crazy is not bad.
EB7A is weird, CAFE is weird, CRAB is weird.
I just met them at the common envelope and mergers at the same time scenario.
Yeah.
Is that weird?
To make sure you remove, you know, in that merger process, you've removed a lot of hydrogen. You haven't left on a solar mass, because then, you know, two solar masses and hydrogen. So it's how do you tune it so you don't, you inject all of it and not leave quite a bit of hydrogen on top.
And then the question is, are you then comfortable saying that the extragalactic 2Bs are similar, so you actually have this relatively large population of mergers that just happens to leave a tenth of a solar mass of hydrogen afterwards? We clearly don't know that you can extrapolate from CASA to all extragalactic 2Bs, but the spectra is very similar of the explosion. So.
Yeah, so the spectra is phenomenology of a particular explosion with a particular amount of hydrogen left, right?
Yeah, well.
My feeling, having not done any compilation stuff, which Lars wouldn't believe anyway, is that the stable mass transfer is much more likely to explain most of the ones with a small amount of hydrogen left of explosion, right?
Yeah.
But if you don't see a companion, then that's not correct.
And yeah, so is CASA just weird, or?
Well, like 87A, something severe went down of CASA 10,000 years before. There's all these dense globules that the supernova has run into that are nitrogen rich, that are expanding slowly and are old.
Mm-hmm.
So it had some kind of big event where
ejection that happened. Yeah, something like 10,000
years before the supernova.
Yeah.
So if there was a merger, it was probably then, not right before.
And so then something like mass loss takes over, and so it's more of a time scale.
Would the common envelope be nitrogen rich?
Yeah.
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 Okay, so that was a bit of a diversion onto the supernova progenitors, but I find it very interesting. But to come back to sort of the populations of yellow supergiants as a whole then, it just sort of feeds into the idea that both for single stars and for binaries, this region kind of is, I'm not going to call it, it's not a sweet spot, but it's one that if you could actually understand how many stars do actually exist in here, because you're predicting vastly different lifetimes depending on what model assumptions go into the single stars, and then you have all of these binary parameters, some of which we have a good handle on, some of which are not well constrained in all of our models, are all sort of happening in this region. So if you could manage to find a large population of them and actually understand what they are and which ones were coming from different evolutionary paths, if you could start to find them and disentangle those things, again, for a large population, they could potentially be sort of a stringent tool of a lot of these different things. And so that's been our goal, is to both identify these stars, and then the important second step, which is where sort of eventually this talk will end in telling you how we're trying to make progress in that, is understanding for any given style that you find here, can you understand what it actually is and which of these various channels it's coming from, and start to build populations of stars that are coming from these different channels. So the first step is just identifying yellow supergiants, and actually, so resolve stars in our galaxy or nearby galaxies. It turns out that this isn't as straightforward as you'd think observationally. So they are, it's really nice, they are bright stars. They're actually the visually brightest stars that exist in any given galaxy because they are luminous, but also your bolometric correction helps you. Most of their flux is coming out in the optical as opposed to in the infrared or in the UV. However, nature played this cruel trick on us where all of the local group galaxies that we might want to look in for large populations of these that we actually know the distance to. So within the Milky Way, you have distance problems, which always hurt your population studies. But it just so happens if you look at a color magnitude diagram of M31, M33, even the LMC and SMC, and you say, okay, this is what magnitude and color a yellow supergiant would be in, that is also exactly the color and magnitude of a foreground dwarf in the Milky Way. And there are a lot of foreground dwarfs in the Milky Way. So you end up with a situation where you actually are something ranging between 80 to 95% contaminated. Like your sample of things that are right color magnitude, 80 to 95% of them will actually be Milky Way dwarfs and not the stars that you're looking for. And this is why, even though they are the visually brightest stars, the known number of yellow supergiants until recently was actually quite low, because it's just a pain, and you get a lot of foreground dwarfs. So it's only in the last sort of decade, as there have been a lot of multi-fiber spectrographs that have come on telescopes and can actually take the time to point at 4,000 of these stars in M31 and pull out the 100 that are actually yellow supergiants. So this is something which we did 4 or 5 years ago. I, along with Phil Massey and Catherine Nugent, published a series of papers on Magellanic Clouds M33 and M31 that identified several hundred yellow supergiants in each of them. So the total number now in those galaxies is around 600 to 700 between those four galaxies. So that was the first step, is finding these populations and understanding where they are on the HR diagram, and then what that means for sort of what are they. Because I just gave you a bunch of different ways that you can make a yellow supergiant. There are a bunch of binary ways. Then there's also the question of if it is a star just going across the first way, or if you're in a situation where the star goes to the red and then comes back to the blue, and trying to understand the difference between those, because you do get situations now, as we've learned, that there are some stellar models that take a long time to march across this. So you want to know if you have a lot of these because it's actually taking a long time, or if you've got things looping back, or you have a lot of binaries in your population. So we're...
Do we even know whether there are more at low metallicity, if you look at different options?
If there are more yellow supergiants at low metallicity. We should be able to answer that, actually, in, as compared to something else, because clearly, you know, the star formation is different between the galaxies. So the one thing I can tell you, and this is what we started to look at, so in the original papers that we published, we took the yellow supergiants themselves and the population of them and just asked the simple question of, are there more high luminosity or low luminosity yellow supergiants, just as a first step. And this is where having a projector might help. But it turns out in these four galaxies, in all the cases, most of your yellow supergiants that you discover are between luminosities of like 4 to up to 5, and there are relatively few above that point, which you might think makes sense with some of these tracks, except if you actually take almost any single star non-rotating stellar track, it turns out they actually predict almost the opposite. And this was true across three different codes that we tested, so Geneva stars and some of the MESA models. If it's non-rotating single stars, it actually, it's these high mass tracks, it's something to do with this intermediate convection zone, that those tracks take a lot longer to get across than the lower luminosity ones do. And so even accounting for things like the IMF, just simple, I mean, we know these aren't true, but non-rotating single star tracks predict you should have a ton of high luminosity yellow supergiants compared to low luminosity ones, and so that's not true.
So you've drawn your hypergiants there at pretty high luminosity. Oh, do they violate the Humphrey-Davidson limit?
A couple of them sort of do, yes. But there are actually, there are very few that are actually up above 6. It's like a couple, one or two in each galaxy.
Yeah, I think the way to say it is that they define it. they are what they know it is.
Yeah. Yes, so Roberta Humphreys knew about some of these when they made the line. Yeah. But yeah, they are what defines sort of it takes a dive down at a certain point, and the fact that they are there is what extends that. So, yeah.
So, Maria, when you did your rate of velocity survey, did you do multi-ethnic?
So, not in the initial survey. We are doing that now. Yes. So, the initial survey was a single snapshot because we were doing 5,000 stars and wanted to know which ones were actually yellow supergiants. But yes, we are now, and I'll get into following up with multiple X to high resolution for all of these. So where was I? So yes, the luminosities within there right off the bat tell you, and this is alleviated as soon as you turn on something like rotation, or also, I understand less of exactly why, but J.J. Eldridge told me that if you turn on binarity as well, this trend tends to reverse, because when you turn on rotation, you get more mixing. It changes your core to envelope fraction. But it just starts to, I don't know if you can recreate the exact luminosity function of these, but it makes it so the tracks no longer predict that you should have vastly more high luminosity than low luminosity yellow supergiants. That's fixed by turning on things like rotation or just mixing. But we also find between these galaxies, say in the LMC, that we have things like that if you take all of the yellow and red stars together, the yellow supergiants are about a third of the total. So there's about twice as many red supergiants as yellow supergiants, which it was something Nathan and I started working on this week, is trying to understand in more detail what you can tell from that. You need to be careful about like where your luminosity cuts are because of what the red supergiants do. But right off the bat, that's more than you would predict if all of the yellow supergiants are just going across for the first time and it only takes 10,000 years. There are more yellow supergiants than you predict there. However, interestingly, when we looked at the MESA, the MIST models for the metallicity of the LMC, we were surprised to learn this week that they actually, as soon as you go to that lower metallicity, they are predicting that almost all of these tracks take a very long time to get across. And so the MESA models were predicting you should have more yellow supergiants than red supergiants for LMC metallicity, which is not what we see at all. So
it's the time you're crossing, not increased numbers of blue loops or something like that.
So say that again. Yeah. Yes, the time itself. So yeah, it's not because blue loops start happening in these MESA models. It's really that you start your helium core burning over in the blue, and you take, and you're doing most of it as you're crossing. And it actually has a very short time scale in the red supergiant branch. So yeah, it's not because of blue loops, in this case, for that set of models that we looked at.
You said this at the start, but that's somewhat dependent on convective assumptions.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, so with sort of whatever the prepackaged MESA models you can download online are, that was what happened. So yes, you can absolutely change that and with how you do that. Because we've also seen other examples of models at LMC metallicity that don't predict that in particular.
What's the typical mass you infer? Just from where they're, I'm seeing your plot, but I'm trying to.
So if I put it on top of some single star models, then.
Yeah, at this point, it's a reasonable.
Just
to give us a sense.
Yeah, so when we defined the samples that we were getting them for, we tried to be complete down to the loop, or at least representative and as complete as we could be down to the luminosity where a typical 12 solar mass track goes across.
But in terms of the majority of the objects you're talking about, that's where the majority.
So it really is a majority are at the lower.
12 to 20.
12, absolutely. So I would even say, yes, absolutely 12 to 20, and even amongst there, 12 to 15 has more than 15 to 20. Yeah.
So you're close to the regime of the objects that we think we're seeing as red supergiants and type 2Ps.
Yes, for some of them.
Not necessarily in a much more. I mean, maybe marginally more massive regime, but the majority of the type 2Ps.
Yeah.
Which is why you're saying they should just be crossing going into the red. Of course, they get brighter.
Yeah.
And they start violating the trivial mass luminosity relation with the supergiant branch at that mass.
Mm-hmm. So
it's not 30 to 50, is what you're saying.
In terms of not at all. Yeah. It's more in that region. Yeah, you actually see very little once you get to. There are very few above luminosity of 5.5 that you see. There are a couple, but very few that are observed up in that region, which makes sense with when a lot of these tracks predict you should no longer actually get over to those temperatures. So we're still trying to piece together whether, our hope was we'd be able to say immediately based on these ratios, like you need a ton of binaries, but it turns out it's not that simple. But we are now trying, so I'm part of a survey that's trying to now take these several hundred yellow supergiants we have and do more detailed studies. So get the data the best that you can that would actually allow you to start to piece together the difference between a lot of these different evolutionary states, whether it's a star going this way, that way, whether it is actively in a binary, whether it's undergoing some mass loss that you don't think it necessarily should. So at this point, we're basically getting multiple epochs of high resolution, so the shallow spectra of most of these. Definitely in the Magellanic Clouds, and we're getting some additional epochs for M31 and M33 as well. They're fainter, so it's a little bit harder. And also, so we have the high resolution spectroscopy, and also information on their variability over about 5-year baseline for these. So this is coming from mainly in the Magellanic Clouds. We're working with people from the Assassin Survey. And in M31 and M33, actually the PTF data is allowing us to look at the variability of these at the same time. And some of the things that, so why this is useful is that there are a number of things. So while any given just temperature and luminosity from photometry could be the same for a number of these different things, there are ways that you should be able to tell the difference between a star that is just making its first passage across and a star that is there via some other evolutionary state. So things that should be different between these stars. So first, their abundances, in particular nitrogen, but also carbon, oxygen, sodium. I'm going to put helium in brackets because it should be different, but you can't detect that at these temperatures. So basically, you have normal abundances going across, but if something's been in the yellow or red supergiant region and is coming back for any reason, you should have enhanced nitrogen, and these other abundances should be modified because of dredge up that's happened. And so you should start to be able to piece together if there are differences between these. You have to be careful in this temperature regime, but as a function of temperature and luminosity, which ones have different abundances. And in particular, when you correlate that together with the variability, because if a star is stripped, you are going to have a different luminosity to mass ratio. And there are a couple of models out there that predict if you are a stripped star in this region as opposed to one going across for the first time, there are some modes or different pulsations that could be excited. So you basically, you expect there to be different types of variability if your luminosity to mass ratio is very different, but you're in the same region of the HR diagram. And so especially when you start to correlate these together, say you see more variability in ones that are nitrogen enhanced, you can start to piece this together. And similarly, their CSM and mass loss, CSM environments or mass loss could be different, to seeing what you can probe around that, seeing things like, is there infrared excess around them? Do we see evidence for mass loss? And then rotation is another one. That's, you need very good data to do this, but we are trying. So V-sin-I's, which it's going to be low for all of these because they're expanded, but if you've also undergone mass loss, it could potentially be even lower, or if something's been spun up for some reason, you could start to detect that as well. And then radial velocities is the other thing, so we are monitoring these for radial velocities. So this is ongoing. We have a few results that I can share with you about this. I don't, again, have final conclusions for you, but I can tell you a few things that we're starting to see as we're doing this for, again, these several hundred yellow supergiants in all these galaxies. So we see interesting differences in both their variability and their mass loss or CSM. In particular, there's about 20 to 40% of these stars show, depending on which galaxy you're in, show H-alpha in some sort of interesting state other than absorption. So we see some that show H-alpha in emission, some that show definite P-Cygni features indicative of wind, some show inverse P-Cygni features, some show interesting types of sort of emission with a core, like you see in BE stars sometimes, but these are not rapid rotators like BE stars. We're seeing a whole variety of different things, which again, most of these are indicative of mass loss, but if you just assume that these stars don't have strong line-driven winds but aren't cool enough for some of these other winds, it's not clear exactly what this mass loss is from, and it might be indicative of some ongoing mass transfer, and that's actually what you're seeing right now. And especially the ones that we're seeing with these interesting H-alpha features are also more variable than the ones that just show H-alpha in absorption. And we're starting to piece together there are correlations between those. And so hopefully that's telling us that these stars are actually in different stages of their evolution, even though they're in very similar regions of the H-alpha diagram based on their colors and luminosities.
What's the sort of timescale, the variability timescale compared to, and I'm not sure exactly how many epochs you have yet.
Yeah, so the variability timescale is on order, it depends on the exact source, and it's almost, some of the ones we see, it's not stochastic, but it's not, there might eventually be a period, but it's not exactly clear what it is, but that's a timescale of like weeks to month or so. And we only have a couple of epochs at this point. Starting this fall, when the LMC's back up, we'll get more epochs and more rapidly and be able to monitor them in conjunction. Yeah. We're doing that. And at the same time, we're now in the process of figuring out the best way to extract the abundances to see if those also correlate with the same variability and CSM properties that we're finding for these stars. So stay tuned because we have a lot of data and a lot more will be coming in over the next year or so for a lot of these stars. Yes?
What about the rotation rates?
Yes. So they definitely show there is variation amongst the ones there. So some are completely unresolved, whereas other ones we do detect some rotation. I'm working now to understand when you at the high level, you also expect the macroturbulent broadening. So we're working the best way to separate that out. But we also see some resolved V sign or broadening for some of the lower luminosity ones where you don't really expect as much of the turbulence. So there are some that have detectable rotation. Yeah.
So I'll follow up on what you were talking about a few minutes ago about the population statistics and
yes.
how the number of yellow supergiants is pretty high relative to red supergiants.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in a relatively low mass regime, which, as Wes points out, overlaps the 2p mm-hmm. per Jenner population.
Yes.
Yet the type 2b, the 2p ratio is maybe 1 to 5.
Yes.
And
yes.
so that should be
a
sign.
In a 5-minute sample.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just checking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that implies that a lot of.
1 to 5, you're saying?
Yeah, it's something like 8% of core collapse versus half of core collapse.
In our
K volume one. So that implies that's a much higher ratio than the ratio of red supergiants to the yellow supergiants there. So that implies that those yellow supergiants have to evolve somewhere else in the HR diagram before.
Yeah, they're not all just going to be go over and explode as yes, absolutely. And yes, that some of them would not. It's not just, it'll be combinations. Some of them should actually be on their way to becoming 2p's, yeah.
Yes.
And some of them could explode there, but you're right, that some of them also, and there are a lot of ways to do that where something passes through that region and then will evolve elsewhere and end their lives elsewhere outside the yellow supergiant region. Absolutely.
Can you remind, for the 2b's, what's the typical inferred hydrogen mass if somebody's bold enough to live it?
So at the left edge, that star is 08AX, where it was like 0.05, and at the right edge, it's like 0.2.
A few times.
There's probably some systematic scaling factor there.
Yeah.
And the helium core, so then the ejecta mass, which you'd get from the peak in the light curve in 18, 20 days, is
a few solar masses.
It's just the helium core, whatever metals came out.
Yeah.
A few solar masses modulo this factor of 2 uncertainty in opacity.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. That's helpful. Mm-hmm. And then is anybody, for the nebular spectroscopy for them?
Yes.
Does the minimal mass agree with what it's done and by a separate group that does?
So people have looked at the oxygen mass in particular, actually, for the 2Bs from the nebular spectra, and argue that it implies that it's broadly consistent and that it implies initial masses of like 18 solar masses.
So my question was going to be, does the inference of the core mass at explosion for those differ? The inference done from nebular spectroscopy, which has been done for 2P, right? So they've done the same exercise for 2Bs. Does it give a different answer? Okay,
that's a good question.
Or does it just look like a 2P? It's the same core
mass,
but it's lost its envelope.
Yeah.
Right?
I think it's not
a different core mass.
I don't remember for sure. I thought it was more it implied a core mass that under single star evolution wouldn't, yeah. I think it might be a little larger, but I mean, there are like three 2Bs that have been done this way.
There's only three 2Bs as well.
Okay, so all right, well, but I don't, I'm not confident enough to say for sure what the comparison is.
Yeah, it's probably a bit more complicated, because 92J at least, the oxygen lines are being cited by supercell interaction, not just, yeah, so.
So if something explodes in the yellow zone, then it's coming back, because if it were any further about to explode, then the residue giant would have to have a lot more hydrogen.
Unless it was stripped over here. I don't know, like, you could probably come up with a way in binary interaction or merger or something else that it didn't necessarily have to make it all new over
but
here.
It, yeah, but I think the statement that if it's in exploding in the yellow, it had to have some
significant mass loss other than, what you
would. I wouldn't agree with that. I would agree, the same, if it makes one of these 2Bs, it has to have mass loss, yes. But I can make things that explode in the yellow that have a lower to hydrogen. They're just not these things.
It's true, because it's similar to the argument for 87A, actually, that, I mean, it's bluer than these. It's like over here somewhere. But it still had 10 solar masses of hydrogen when it exploded, even though it was that blue. So you could come up with a way, probably via mergers or something. Well, I don't know. But that, yeah. But that wouldn't be a 2B, because those definitely only have that much hydrogen left. But yeah, you probably could explode in that region with, you could come up with a way to explode in that region with more hydrogen left.
That's right. But you can come up a way with a single star and have it be in the yellow. And because it's having a mass, so all we said is some enhanced mass loss. A7A is an example of that, right? It's blue because it did have a binary and had some mass loss helping it.
Mass gain.
Well, when they blew, it wasn't like extensive mass loss, but a change in internal structure. The internal structure was because of the inertia. So, I mean, there was some mass loss, but it's not that amount of the mass loss made it blue.
Yeah.
Right. So, can you comment, or perhaps someone else, about the actual mass loss prescriptions in this temperature regime? Because you mentioned at the beginning.
Yeah.
Because usually you have something that's calibrated to red supergiants.
Yeah, I mean,
this is a different
maybe you can, but my impression is it just flips at.
Just draw a line between two regimes.
Yeah.
Usually in MASA, for example, you interpolate between what you use on the hot side, which is the pink prescription, and what you use on the red side. So that's the default in MASA.
Yeah,
you
interpolate between the two. And yeah, the hot ones, you know, are calibrated for main sequence, and the red ones are calibrated on a red supergiant. And but if you really are only taking 10,000 years, it doesn't matter. But
fins are provided by different physics on the left side and
yes.
the right.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
there's no measurements, right?
Yes.
Okay.
As far as I know.
So basically,
these are the like measurements. We've just seen them.
Yeah. So we are working to figure out the best way to pull out a mass, an empirical mass loss rate from the.
I think the ones where you have HL ignition might be binaries with the stellar.
Yeah, it's not clear. It's actually just a wind coming off of these stars at all. In fact, it might not be.
Yeah, so is optical really the best way to go as opposed to free emission on massive stars?
Yeah, so we're also, yes, absolutely. Yes, that is another way to probe this. And for some of these as well, you do see infrared excesses, so you can do the similar type of analysis that you do for the red supergiants on the yellow supergiants. But again, it's only ones that actually show this, which is about maybe 30% of them or so.
Depending on the temperature that are things recombined, though, maybe it'll be pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Do we know anything about mass loss from Cepheids?
There are some people who have looked at this. I think Hilding has, actually, at the University of Toronto. I don't know a ton about it. I know that there are some cases, I think, where they've argued for changing mass loss at different points in it, or in a similar sort of, you can have stuff driven by the pulsations themselves.
Are there estimates for time average mass loss rates?
There might be.
Because they're just low luminosity.
Yeah, supergiants. No, it's true. And yeah, I don't know those numbers off the top of my head. But yeah, people have looked at this a bit, in particular trying to understand or sort of watch Cepheids evolve, and it's important to take into account the mass loss when you do that. So yeah, it has been done for some Cepheids.
Okay, probably one of the best ways to get UV spectra of neutral atomic resonance lines and measure PC performance. That takes a lot of work, and almost nobody works on this.
Well, they don't allow small HST proposals anymore.
Well, there's a medium one.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you interpret your inversion anymore?
Yeah, so that's fun. So this has also been observed in a couple. There are several of these galactic, like, yellow hypergiants also show this, but it's a transient phenomenon. It's not just there the whole time. So the idea is something like, I don't know, you try to launch something, but parts of it fall back in, so you're not successfully creating a full outflow, but at some points you see, yeah, stuff coming in. But it shouldn't be stable like that. So that those ones in particular are ones we're targeting for multiple ethics to make sure we understand how that's evolving with time.
It's kind of generic. You have, you know, shock ejection with not much mass. You know, a bit goes above this gate velocity and a lot.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Any other comments, questions, deep insights?
Can I comment more on mechanisms for variability in these?
Yeah, that was something I was hoping to learn while I was here and didn't manage to. So yeah, it's something that I still don't understand what is causing the intrinsic variability you see in a lot of these. They do have convective atmospheres, and so understand that perhaps some of it is coming from that or different pulsations that happen in it. But no, I still don't actually know good mechanism. I don't know if
it
does.
I wasn't listening. So.
Yeah.
is there an upper limit to the setting stability strip? And if so, why? Like, why does it stop?
I mean, I haven't observed one, absolutely, because we've now looked at the light curves for
all. You
diagonally? Nobody has ever shown it on theoretical grounds, and it keeps on going. And the thing is, once you get up into that range of luminosities, there are other instabilities that come into play that probably make the Cepheid instability, and most importantly, strange mode instabilities seem to inhabit that part of the HR diagram. And their growth rates are so short that they kind of stop all over the Cepheid instability.
And it also, the temperature, the diagonal does continue, so sort of when it stops, it's getting into this cool regime where most of it is sort of below the like 6,000 Kelvin, which is important for a lot of things in the atmosphere. So it sort of seems to coincide with when it's pushing into that regime as well. So yeah, there's definitely an observed upper limit to it.
Well, I mean, I haven't thought about it, but I mean, there is intrinsic variability, I mean, as you know well, you know, the red supergiant branch.
Absolutely.
Right? And of course, we know that for AGB stars and red giant branch stars, it's basically just the extension of acoustic excitation of modes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody's done it, but
yeah.
You know, one can just ask, sort of in this regime,
mm-hmm.
if you just took those empirical luminosity, there's, you know, empirical relations that are now well calibrated between Kepler for nearby giants and then for distant giants, things that took the red giant branch, that's only 10^3.5, so it's, you know, it's only a order of magnitude down.
Yeah, I'd say it's a question of whether you
can. Well measured empirical correlation of amplitude of variability versus luminosity of the star. And that's just large scale acoustic waves, L equals mm-hmm. 0, L equals 1, L equals 2.
But those are stochastically excited, aren't they?
Correct. Sorry. But they get to amplitudes, but you know, these are amplitudes half magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
Easy.
Mm-hmm.
So I just haven't looked at just that phenomenology, whether that could be part
but
of the
But it could actually extend up there, yeah.
Because the bright detection is vigorous, the mm-hmm. envelopes are thin.
Yeah.
There's not much mass in the envelope, so I mean, it seems to me it's worth checking.
But could you diagnose the mass of the envelope?
From that?
Yeah.
Well, the question is, you're not seeing periodicity, are you?
It's not clear.
Not clear.
Yeah.
You haven't mentioned regular velocity?
Yeah, so we're still getting the multiple epochs to...
Yeah,
really
well, that'll help.
We have one or two epochs now, and then this fall we have a bunch of time once the LMC is up again. So
the question related to what you were just saying, Lars, let's say that the star would have been a red supergiant, would have been pulsating like a red supergiant, right? A companion star stripping off the outer layers, making it yellowish orange. Where is the variability then before?
Right. Well, you know, Arco Bohr stars, don't forget, which are even totally weirder than what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But they're sitting at 10 to the 4-ish helium envelopes, and at 10 to the 4, 10 to the 4 on both axes. They're a little, well, they're yellow, so they're yellow. And they're variable. You know, never mind their outbursts, but they are variable, intrinsically variable objects, so.
Yeah. I mean, it's just interesting because we are seeing, so I have examples of like two stars that I would put basically on top of each other. One shows variability, one doesn't.
Right. And that's a big deal for whether or not they're on the way to the red or in a blue loop because the L will remember it completely different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but don't forget that there are countless main sequence stars that are inside instability strips that show variability.
That don't actually.
So, you know, those stars, there's not even any question about whether they're at the same evolutionary stage.
Why?
Yeah, why is there no question, actually?
Yeah. I mean, it's working on understanding why you get a null result, and you know, that's kind of not the most attractive research at all.
Yeah, like there are plenty of things in the C-feed strip that don't.
I think the ratio in any case is ill-defined because what counts is not variable. It depends on what instrument you use. I mean, you know, as with the launch of Kepler, the number of stars that are not variable has gone down.
These are what, delta Cygni stars?
These are Cepheids.
Yeah, even
Cepheids. Oh, no, you mean on the main sequence? Yeah, no, these are CPI and SPB stars.
But there are stars in the Cepheid regime that don't do Cepheid stuff, so.
So you mentioned that one of the problems in getting galactic samples is, of course, distance ambiguities, but now with
Gaia will help, not for all of them, because some of them are saturated. But it will help, yes.
You might as well just take spectrum of almost everything in the galaxy.
Yes, you should.
What's Gaia's brightness?
That's not right, is it?
That's what I remember.
Well, I'm glad we're on top of this.
Yeah.
So
that's too faint. Yeah,
that's too faint. 12, 13.
Because that's what you're measuring the distance of, right? That's what
in Gaia.
Oh, sure, yeah.
All
foreground
objects and fair amount.
Yeah.
You're saying foreground containments, a lot of them are saturated.
No, yellow supergiants in the Milky Way.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, those,
yeah. Oh, yeah, those, sorry. No, for that other stuff, yeah. So it would also help for these other galaxies to sort out based on, yeah. Absolutely. But no, for the ones that are in the galaxy themselves and getting proper distances to those, yeah.
But you know, presumably at some distance they come not saturated, you just get your color magnitude diagram and slice it like that, right?
Yes, yeah.
So has anybody done this?
No, not yet.
Because can you exploit the volumetric correction to make purer samples for spectroscopic follow-up, like in external galaxies? So you use far infrared, like WISE colors, or to cull it?
See, the problem then is that a number of these do have sort of shells around them. So if you go to like
too red, then
it's okay. Not, and it's even so color magnitude and color diagram. It's. In most of the optical and near-infrared colors, they just happen to exactly overlap. And then once you go far infrared, you start to have issues with ones that have shells versus don't. So.
But at least they'll get the look of those as dwarfs.
Yes. Yeah. That's true.
It's 20. It's 20. It's 20.
It is 20?
From the ESA website.
From the website.
Oh, right. Okay. I always think about it in that infrared limit, which is right there.
Excellent.
So before everybody disappears, that was our last talk. I want to thank everybody for contributing to the workshop. I have enjoyed it. It's sad that it's finishing. But I liked it. So thanks also to Lars for hosting our workshop and letting us run
the way we want it to run.
I'm glad that that's how you interpret it.
Well, I think that's called divorce. to a little bit celebrate Annie Gabriel's son, Californian type champagne. So if you can join like in the patio in a few minutes. It's alcoholic for those who don't drink alcoholic champagne. So just let's meet in a few minutes in the patio and celebrate the ending of the workshop.
Well, and thanks, let me just remind people that we do have this opportunity called the follow-ons that we're still doing. So we can talk, just remind everyone, it's an opportunity to come back in small collaborations, 2 to 6 people for 1 or 2 weeks, wrapping something up, or presumably maintaining momentum. And that announcement should be going out for Maggie at some point. When the time window is, it'll be, I'm looking at Natasha, did you get an answer from Maggie? No, well, whatever. Just reminding people that that is something we're still doing for.
How much later after this?
It's a random variable. This is determined by when we only have 2 programs, so I can do it in a minute. The most likely first opportunity, which would be late fall, but it may be next winter at this point. I have to. But it's between 6 and 18 months, basically.
And thanks to the coordinators.
Yes.
A lot of work.